today on Against the Grain. They're called free universities, not just because they're free of charge, but because they promote a freedom to imagine ways of learning and ways of being in the world that conventional universities, with their increasingly capitalism-oriented logics and regimes, don't. I'm CS, the anthropologist and activist Fern Thompson joins me to talk about free universities, including the one she co-founded, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is CS Song. What if you went to college to learn stuff, not for purposes of getting a degree or impressing a future employer, but rather just to learn? What if the university experience was about critical inquiry, critical thinking, rather than acquiring marketable skills? What if the university were disconnected from the cash economy? There was no tuition. The focus was not on research that could benefit private interests. You didn't have administrators catering to big donors and corporate bigwigs. They're not large. There aren't a whole lot of them. But free universities have become part of the educational landscape, and they represent a challenge to the capitalist logics that have come to permeate, and you might say infect, conventional universities and society at large. Fern Thompson, who has researched free universities as well as co-founded one herself, writes that free universities stand as a testament to the human capacity for resistance and creativity in the face of capitalism's otherwise potentially totalizing paradigm. As such, free universities invite us to imagine not just a better university, but a better world. Fern Thompson is an organizer, an activist, and a PhD student in anthropology at McGill University in Montreal. She co-founded the Brisbane Free University in Australia, and she's researched more than 24 other free university projects in the US, Canada, and Mexico. Fern has also contributed a chapter about free universities to the volume Anthropologies of Value, Cultures of Accumulation Across the Global North and South. When Fern Thompson joined me recently from Montreal, I asked what motivated her and a couple friends to establish the Brisbane Free University.
In 2012, at the time, I'd finished my study at the university that I had been previously studying at, and I was casually employed as a tutor, as we call them in Australia, but I think in the US they're more commonly referred to as TAs or teaching assistants. So I was involved in what we can call the conventional university or the normal university at the time, and there were a couple of things that were coming to the surface through my work that kind of rubbed me the wrong way in terms of what I was seeing from students and what I was seeing from staff who were involved in the university. Predominantly the fact that I was feeling like where there could have been more of a focus on free and critical thinking and the development of skills and capacities to those ends, these things were being eclipsed by more of a focus on a commodified form of education and certainly a focus on accreditation rather than the process of learning itself. So there seemed to be this kind of predisposition towards getting to the end of one's studies that I was becoming aware of amongst the student body rather than focusing on what we might call learning for its own sake or learning towards critical thinking. And this is not at all to lay that on the students themselves. I think that that was simply symptomatic of a broader structural issue, which was the fact that with rising tuition fees in Australia, there was also rising student debt and consequentially an increase in anxieties that people were experiencing about their inevitable entry into the job market. So that was one thing, that was kind of the involvement with the normal university arm of how BFU was formed. But of course there was a different arm, and this one is a little less conventional in terms of the founding of this sort of a project, but that was because, I mean, it was no coincidence that we created Brisbane Free University in 2012. That was obviously the year 2011 to 2012 was the time at which Occupy encampments were taking off around the world. And we had our own Occupy in Brisbane. It was a relatively small one compared to Occupies around Australia, but it was It was relatively long-standing, despite its size, or perhaps because of its size. And as I was walking home from work one day through the city, I walked through Occupy Brisbane, and I noticed that there was a tent set up that was dedicated to community learning projects. So people would just offer to teach something in the tent on any given day, and there was a chalkboard out the front where the classes were listed, and there was this whole gamut of things that you could just wander into the tent and learn for free. And I thought that was a fantastic idea, and it responded to some of the concerns that I was having around the normal university where I was working that had been building up over time. And so when the Occupy encampment in Brisbane eventually disbanded, I thought there's no reason why those sorts of aspects of the project can't continue without the encampment more broadly. And so in the end, it was a combination of frustrations around the normal university and then also the fact that we'd borne witness to these potentialities of learning happening in other spaces through other mechanisms of organisation, consensus-based decision-making and all the rest of it that we combined together to kind of give birth to the mutant love child that became the Brisbane Free University.
And yet the fact that you use the word university in the name of this project, Brisbane Free University, suggests to me that you and your collaborators continue to value certain ideals still represented by a university education. Is that true?
Absolutely. And it's a really interesting point of interrogation into the project itself, and indeed free universities more broadly. Just to give you a bit of background, the use of the word university for free universities is not innocent. And in fact, there was a project that was running for several years in Copenhagen in Denmark called the Copenhagen Free University that was eventually shut down by order of the Danish government because they weren't allowed to use the word university in their name unless they were a state-sanctioned project, which obviously they weren't. They were anti-state. And so we were somewhat aware of these sorts of issues as we were deciding what to call the Brisbane Free University, and you'll probably believe me when I tell you that it took many months of discussion actually for us to come up with a name. As simple as the name sounds, Brisbane Free University, there was really a lot of thought wrangling behind it. We were certainly in some ways hesitant to use the word university because we were trying to edge away from what the university, or what normal universities rather, for us had come to represent. So we did want to establish some kind of a separation between our project and normal universities and their dynamics. At the same time, we wanted for our project to represent a form of symbolic protest that was linked to normal universities. We wanted our project to be in some ways a form of leverage that would catalyze a radical reimagination of what the university is or could be for people who had some experience with the normal university or maybe not. But I think you also, in the way that you phrased your question, you hit upon another really important aspect in why we decided to retain that word in our title, which is that our project wasn't entirely antagonistic. It wasn't entirely supposed to be a pushback against the university. And in fact, one of the reasons that we wanted to found the Brisbane Free University, and I'm speaking here on behalf of three co-founders, two dear friends and myself, is that we all really enjoyed the majority of our experience at normal universities. We're total critical theory nerds. We think that kind of critical thinking and study of power dynamics in mainstream society is vitally important. We just didn't see it happening in exactly the way that we would idealize within normal universities. And so our project was never intended to dismantle or replace the normal university. It was just intended to, as a provocation, I suppose, to encourage people to think about how normal universities were failing us in particular ways and how they could be operating better.
So what kinds of classes were offered at the Brisbane Free University and are offered, and where were classes held?
Oh, two really good questions. What sorts of classes? That's a bigger and broader one than you might imagine because of the way that the project operated. So when we founded the Brisbane Free University, one of the things that we wanted it to represent politically was the fact that we believe that people should be involved more democratically in the things that they wanted to learn and the sorts of pedagogies that they engaged with in order to learn those things. And so we didn't want to establish the Brisbane Free University as a kind of bounded sovereign project unto itself. We wanted for it to be a platform that was available for broad use throughout the community. And so our launch event wasn't actually a class. It was a giant public meeting of people at which we kind of humbly and one of the co-founders always uses this phrase that I really love, where she calls the Brisbane Free University a fumble-friendly project, quote unquote. And so we kind of pitched the idea with that sort of a tone behind the way that we described it. We said, look, we've had this idea. It's super weird. It might work. It might not. But one of the main things that we want to do with it is simply open a space and hear from you, the people in attendance, what it is that you would like to learn within this space. If anyone would like to offer their thoughts as forms of teaching or would like to facilitate a session or suggest a session that we might be able to organize on behalf of someone else, or run a session yourselves entirely, that's exactly what we're here for. And as a consequence, we got this broad, weird, super diverse kind of tapestry of different classes that were all happening within this space at different times. Many of them did continue to be organized by the three of us as the co-founders. But particularly at the start and actually increasingly as the project went on, we'd have people approaching us from all different walks of life, suggesting classes that they could teach on particular things or particular topics that they wanted to learn about. So we had this really rich mix between things that were very practical, like we had guitar playing classes, we had vocal technique classes, then we had some quite abstract philosophical courses on ethical reasoning, and we also had a lot of locally politically embedded classes, which was one of the things that we were angling for with the project over the course of its running, and it continues to run, I should say. So we worked in tandem with a number of local organizations as well, and just to mention a couple of them, one of them is a fantastic organization called Sisters Inside. It's a feminist prison abolitionist organization operating in Brisbane, and so we came together with them to put on a session about prison abolition. We also invited a number of local Aboriginal speakers to talk about local Aboriginal struggles in the area. We had people speak on refugee issues. Someone from the public suggested a session on Gaza in 2014. And so we ran a session on the background and context of the conflict that was happening in Gaza at the time. So yeah, there was this very broad range of classes that happened within the space. And the space itself was a particularly interesting one. We actually ended up hosting most of the Brisbane Free University sessions in a parking lot that was semi-underground. And one of the reasons that we chose it was that it was absolutely open access. People could just walk in off the street, and often they did. And that was something that we really wanted to encourage, was for people to be able to participate in conversations that they wouldn't normally plan to go to, that they were just able to attend absolutely spontaneously. And also that people would come together in conversations with each other over the course of the sessions that wouldn't normally be able to meet. And one of the things that worked really well with the space that we used was also that because there was no doorway and we didn't ever charge access fees to any of our events, people had the opportunity to meet one another in ways that were not mediated by any form of commercial interest or exchange of money. So as opposed to people going out and meeting each other in bars or in restaurants, people could just wander into this space and strike up a conversation with someone that they'd never met before, and it had absolutely nothing to do with the cash economy. And that for us was something that felt really emancipatory in and of itself.
That's Fern Tomsich. She's a PhD student in anthropology at McGill University in Montreal. She's also an organizer and an activist, and she contributed a chapter about free universities to the volume Anthropologies of Value, Cultures of Accumulation Across the Global North and South. It's published by Pluto Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you did never charge access fees, and you wanted to the maximum extent, stay outside of the cash economy This obviously relates to the free part of the word free university, of the term Brisbane Free University. Does the word free and free universities have another meaning?
Of course. The free and free university is intended to have a double meaning. It means, on the one hand, free entry, free of cash, but it means, on the other hand, that we intended for the project to be emancipatory in some way. And I think that related to our understanding that in terms of being involved or mobilizing an anti-capitalist project, there are aspects of anti-capitalist projects that do purely relate to the cash economy and that are more materially focused, I guess you could say, in that sense. But there's also really important anti-capitalist work to be done in terms of pushing back psychologically, socially and culturally against the kinds of social norms and mores that are established when we live in a culture in which capitalism is the dominant economic model. Obviously, that doesn't only come to transform the ways in which we interact with each other economically, but it also comes to transform the ways in which we value ourselves as subjects, or the ways in which we form relationships with other people, or indeed the ways in which we come to think about what it is to learn, what it is to study together, and what are legitimate endpoints and means as well, for which and through which that learning takes place. And so, yeah, there were different ways in which we tried to mobilize within that realm of study. Obviously, one of them was removing a cash price for entry to any of our sessions. But we were also trying to give a platform to voices that might have been more marginalized within the Brisbane community at the time, and be able to tell stories that were otherwise shut out from mainstream discourses, partly, and this certainly relates to our critiques of the normal university, but partly because they were simply less marketable than other voices. So, for example, we wanted to give platforms to folks who are undertaking really interesting research projects that didn't necessarily get funded by grants, because they didn't spew out into salable end products, but that were still critically important in terms of really interrogating our social systems and whatnot. So things like people who were doing research on homelessness in Brisbane, or on legalization of different sorts of drugs, things that were possibly seen to be a little too edgy to take up too much space within the mainstream media, we wanted to give space to those sorts of voices and stories. But then there's another way as well. So that's talking about the content. But we also intended for the free, meaning emancipatory, to relate to the ways in which that content was communicated and the ways in which the project itself was organized. So the fact that we really encouraged people to ask questions no matter what their level of formal education was, even if someone had wandered in off the street and had only been sitting in the session for 10 minutes, their question that they asked in the question period was every bit as valuable as someone else's. And similarly, we tried to encourage people to become involved in the project at an organizational level if they had the capacity and the interest. And so we'd hold open public meetings regularly at which people could suggest sessions that they wanted to either organize or engage with.
And, you know, maybe we should have began with this, but how do you define the term free university?
One of the first things when we were starting to think about founding the Brisbane Free University, by a miraculous coincidence, I also began to work with one of the co-founders of the Melbourne Free University, who was a wonderful asset to the project and remains one, and gave us a lot of really important pieces of advice. But one of the first things that he said is, look, our projects share a name, we're both free universities, but a free university is not a franchise. One of the most important things about free universities is that they're all locally specific, so they all develop somewhat organically within their particular political and social context. And what that means is that a free university is incredibly and beautifully difficult to define, because they're all incredibly diverse, and that's kind of the point. But it does mean that when one comes to write about free universities, as I later did, it's a bit of a stumbling block. So I had to come up with a few clumsy criteria to kind of delimit the sorts of projects that I was exploring. So I came up with a few. One, the more obvious one, is that free universities have to be free to attend, so no cover charge. Some of them do charge cover for particular things at particular times, but usually their main policy is that it's free access. I made it a policy within my research that I was only looking at projects that don't offer accreditation. Some projects are free to attend, but they do offer accreditation. And for me, although I think that that's a really interesting and politically salient project in other ways, I was especially drawn to projects that were trying to get away from the commodification of learning and the feedback loops between learning and the job market that had plagued me. So I was focusing on projects that don't offer accreditation. And it was also important for me that whichever free university or free university-like project made an allusion in the description of the project itself to some kind of emancipatory endpoint, however that might have been expressed, but that it wasn't only kind of a pleasurable coming together freely to do life drawing classes every couple of weeks or yoga classes, as much as those sorts of classes in a very real sense were part of the free universities, many of the free universities that I looked at. For me, I was looking at projects that had some kind of a broader political purview. Most of the time that ended up being an explicit anti-capitalist orientation. Some free universities were also anti-state, and in fact all of the ones that I looked at avoided state affiliation, but it was only a certain number of them that were explicitly anti-state or that self-defined as anarchist.
So when you say that under your definition of free universities, they have a radical agenda, or maybe more than a bit, do you mean that the learning ought to be political action oriented, that, you know, every kind of class or most classes offered by these universities has an action oriented component in the political or social realm, or that, you know, because on the other hand, you could say, well, learning should be for its own sake. So whatever it is, you know, it could just be we learn about it, and it doesn't have to have an endpoint in a political sense. So where do people stand on that?
This was such an I'm really glad that you asked me this. This was such an interesting tension that wove right throughout my interviews, and it really encapsulated something that I'd been wrestling with within the context of Brisbane Free University itself. But exactly this tension between having an explicitly politically radically oriented agenda versus trying to open spaces within which learning could be engaged with, quote unquote, for its own sake. So I think that, yeah, to explore these tensions further, let's just take it as a given that the free universities with which I spoke and interacted were anti-capitalist, and the vast majority of them were. But then when we think about this anti-capitalist political orientation, this can unroll in a number of different ways, right? And we can think about free universities putting on classes that were explicitly and directly anti-capitalist. So, for example, when I was traveling across North America and interviewing organizers of and participants in a whole range of different free universities, I was hard-pressed to find a free university that hadn't run some kind of a reading group on Marxist theory, right? Whether it was Capital, or whether it was Silvia Federici, or whether it was Kathy Weeks' Critiques of Work. There was a whole range of very explicitly anti-capitalist sorts of classes that were happening. And I think that that's a really important part of many of the projects, and it's something that we can think about as one that mobilizes a kind of oppositional politics in terms of its anti-capitalism. So it's a direct attack, or it's a direct critique of capitalist systems that are at play. But on the other hand, there was this other really interesting side to nearly all of the free universities with which I interacted, which was, rather than the oppositional politics, it's something that we might be able to think about as more of a prefigurative politics, or a bringing into being the sort of world in which we seek to live. And that was one in which people were able to engage in learning about a whole range of different topics, purely, and here again, I quote, for its own sake. And a lot of the ways in which people rationalized that to me was that if we were living in a world in which capitalism has been abolished, let's allow ourselves to dream radically and wildly, then that's exactly what we'd be able to do. We wouldn't need to be laboring over Marx's Capital Volume 1 anymore, and we wouldn't need to be having to theorize and re-theorize situationism or different forms of anti-capitalist struggles that have taken place through histories. We would be able to sit down together and learn Sanskrit purely out of interest because of the fact that it has absolutely no market value, nor does it have any kind of value within the purview of anti-capitalist struggle necessarily. It's simply something that people enjoy and people want to be able to come together and enjoy together. And so why not? And so there was this beautiful kind of why not mentality that permeated many of the projects and many of the organizers with whom I spoke. They linked that to a form of anti-capitalism that's not necessarily self-evident on the surface, but it ran deep through these sorts of classes as well.
Her name is Fern Thompson. She is a graduate student in anthropology at McGill University, and she contributed a chapter about free universities to the volume Anthropologies of Value. She's also written about free universities in other publications, and she co-founded again the Brisbane Free University in Brisbane, Australia in late 2012. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Fern. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Fern Thompson joins us. She is an anthropologist. She is an activist. She is an organizer. And she has been writing about free universities, including in the volume Anthropologies of Value. It's published by Pluto Press. She contributed a chapter about free universities to that new volume. And she co-founded the Brisbane Free University, and she's also researched about 25 free university projects throughout North America. So let's talk a little bit more about money, because going without cash assumes, it presumes that people, whether teachers or organizers or students or space providers at these free universities, can afford to offer their time, energy, and resources without remuneration. I'm guessing that that presumption is not always correct, and so I'm wondering to what degree free universities are able to stay outside of the cash economy.
That's a doozy and a really important question. When I set off around the US, Canada, and Mexico to meet with folks who'd also been organizing and participating in free universities, there were a number of things that I was thinking to ask, and activist burnout was not one of those things. But within the first month of traveling around and interviewing people, it was the number one topic of conversation that kept resurfacing again and again. And I think it's a pivotal issue for a number of reasons. I think in one very pragmatic sense, it speaks to the longevity or lack thereof of these projects. And it's worth mentioning that many free universities are quite ephemeral. There were a number that I met with that have been in operation for perhaps around a decade, perhaps longer. But many of them run for a number of years and then they cease to operate. And often that's due to activist burnout on the part of the organizers. And so I think that there's that very pragmatic level to why that question is a really important one to ask. But I think it also speaks to something more profound, to a more profound tension within the landscape of anti-capitalist organizing. And that's this tension between emancipation and self-exploitation, for want of a better way of describing it. So the fact that even though these people were coming together to organize an ostensibly anti-capitalist project, many of the organizers, if not all of the organizers, also had to have day jobs so that they could afford to pay their own rent and buy their own groceries and all the rest of it. And so perhaps a valuable way to think about free universities is that all of the ones with which I interacted, at least, they saw themselves as these kind of ephemeral microcosms of a potentiality of anti-capitalism within a broader society that remained decidedly capitalist. And while that can have some really interesting upshots in terms of provoking people to reimagine the way that society could be, or the ways in which we can form relationships to one another and to learning, at a material level, it certainly threw up some problems. And I think I came to conceptualize those problems in two main ways. One was in terms of labor, in terms of the fact that organizers would find themselves laboring within the cash economy by day and then outside of the cash economy by night, and would often end up burning themselves out. But then the other place in which that tension became really apparent was in terms of the use of space. So we were really lucky with the Brisbane Free University in that we were able to negotiate the use of this particular parking lot for free. But that was certainly anomalous. Most of the free universities that I found across North America were either paying rent for a private but community-oriented space, which they would use in which to have their classes, or else they were using privately owned spaces for which people would pay rent. So either way, it's really difficult in the end to disentangle yourself from the capitalist system. And I always remember this interview, or a conversation rather, that I had with an organizer of the Bay Area Public School in Oakland, who said, well, you know, either we're in these spaces for which we're paying rent, and that's something that we can do collectively as the Free University Project, or else we're piggybacking on other people who are paying rent, or else we can meet somewhere like a park. But of course, I was conducting my interviews 2 years after most of the Occupy encampments across North America had been forcibly evicted, not without the use of quite a substantial amount of police violence and brutality. And so people at the time were really thinking cynically about just how free the use of so-called public spaces like parks across certainly the US at least actually is. And so they found themselves in some ways feeling, perhaps paradoxically, like all of their efforts to provide some kind of emancipatory space outside of the cash economy were being cornered back into these capitalist-driven systems that really govern the use of space.
Yeah, you can't really stay pure, can you? You can't. I mean, there seems like there's an effort to try and create something outside of capitalism, and yet, as you're suggesting, capitalism seems to seep into every aspect of our lives.
Right. And for sure, on the one hand, I think that can engender a reaction of despair for many people, particularly people who are committed to the anti-capitalist struggle or to diverse anti-capitalist struggles. But on the other hand, there's a different way to conceptualize this whole complex landscape of non-capitalist microcosms within a broader capitalist system. And for that reconceptualization, I've drawn quite heavily on the theorists J.K. Gibson Graham. They're two people, but they write with a hyphenated surname as one person. And they make a really potent and valuable argument that we can also read these landscapes in other ways. We could, on the one hand, read it as the fact that capitalist systems tend to metabolize and assimilate absolutely anything that they find back into them, and therefore they're impossible to escape and there's no way out. But at the same time, we can recognize the fact that capitalism is never pure either, and that there are always these holes within it and these ways in which we relate to each other that do escape, at least to a significant degree, the cash economy. And we can really kind of keep those places at the fore of our vision and remember that capitalism stronghold is never absolute. There are always these ways in which people come together creatively to resist, and ways in which in some ways they're always on the crest of the wave. You know, like a lot of people that I interviewed, they'd tell me, we're actually always a step ahead. Like, even though capitalism might, or capitalist systems rather, might sweep in behind whatever activist project it is that we're doing and gobble it up through burnout or through gentrification or through imposing rent on a space or whatever the case may be, we're also always a step ahead in terms of imagining the world outside of these capitalist systems and against these capitalist systems. So I really take heart in that notion that we can read these complex landscapes in complex and diverse ways, and they don't all lead us to the dead end of a capitalist stronghold.
Well, there's so much to ask about. Can you give us the names and locations of some of the free universities and so-called free schools that you became acquainted with during your research, so people have a sense of the landscape?
Sure. You want me to name names? I can do that. So just before I do this, some of the projects with which I met were actually projects of the past that had already been laid to rest but had maybe morphed into different forms. And some of the projects that I encountered have since been put to rest. And so this isn't at all an up-to-date or current list. But so I started out in the Bay Area and met with the Bay Area Public School, which was at the time operating in Oakland and I believe continues to operate in Oakland. I also met with the Free School Santa Cruz, obviously in Santa Cruz. From there, I traveled up to Vancouver and met with the Vancouver Institute for Social Research. I also headed south to Mexico and I visited two different iterations of a project known as Universidad de la Tierra or Unitierra. There are actually a couple of iterations of that project in operation in the US as well, but I went to Oaxaca City in Oaxaca and also San Cristóbal de las Casas in Chiapas, where there are two different sites of that project running. They're very different iterations of the project, I should say, but they do share the same name. From there, I headed to the east coast of the US and I met with some folks working with Freedom U in Athens, Georgia, which was a project established directly in support of undocumented students that were being denied entry onto university campuses in Georgia at the time, and I believe that continues to be the case. I headed north and I visited the Free School Baltimore. Then up to New York City, where I hung out with some folks at the Bruce High Quality Foundation University, which is a fine art free university project. Up to Halifax, where I met with some members of the Radical Imagination Project, one of whom had also formerly been involved with Edufactory by the name of Max Haven. Across to Montreal, which is where I'm now based, where I interviewed folks associated with a project called University of the Streets, which is an interesting one because it's actually affiliated with a normal university but met the rest of the criteria. Then on to Toronto, where I spoke with folks who'd formerly been involved with the Anarchist Free University, the Toronto School of Creative Inquiry, and the Toronto Free School.
That's Fern Thompson. She is working toward her PhD in anthropology at McGill University. She co-founded the Brisbane Free University in Australia and also Radio Reversal, that is a research-based community radio program on 4ZZZ FM in Brisbane, Australia. And she is an organizer, an activist, and a writer. And I found a chapter she wrote about free universities that she contributed to the volume Anthropologies of Value. That book is published by Pluto Press. Can you give us a bit of history? I'm wondering when free universities first emerged.
Sure. I guess to give the simpler answer first, the first project that called itself a free university was established during the 1960s at UC Berkeley, and it was established by some of the members of Students for a Democratic Society. In fact, it's really worth reading the statement that they put out called the Port Huron Statement that's available online. I read it a few years after I'd done these interviews around North America, and some of the phrases in it, it's almost uncanny. They echo almost word for word the concerns that people are still talking about today. So that free university at UC Berkeley was established in order to contest what Students for a Democratic Society were seeing as the loss of focus on critical thinking and critical inquiry in favour of a more marketable and commodified form of education. They were also protesting the military-industrial complex and how that was taking too much of a hand in terms of university research. And so there was a whole proliferation of free universities across the US during the 1960s and 70s. Then they died down for a little while during the 80s, but they really came back to the fore with the rise of anti-globalization movements from the 1999 protests in Seattle and through to Occupy. We saw a kind of a regrowth of free universities across North America. Of course, the history goes back a lot further than that. And once you start looking at this history, you of course have to ask the question, well, how do we define a free university if we're not using the word free university? And when you think about the definition that I offered earlier, that it's a project of collective study that's free to attend, that in most cases organizes itself horizontally or democratically or through consensus-based decision-making, that's a lot of different forms of human social gatherings right throughout history. I mean, like, if you think about the very start of human societies, people would come together to teach one another different things. Now, obviously, they wouldn't have been called free universities at the time, but it's the same idea. So when you start looking back through history, I ended up drawing inspiration from a whole different range of sources that weren't initially in my purview at all. So, for example, in Maroon communities of escaped slaves after the settling or invasion or colonization, however you want to refer to it, of what's now known as the United States of America, a lot of how people came together in those communities was through study. Study as a form of resistance and a sort of study that very directly was linked in with social justice struggles and autonomous empowerment. In a similar sense, and you can read about this in Silvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch, women who were excluded from decision-making or dynamics of power within mainstream society would also come together to share knowledge and skills in ways that were self-empowering. So when you think about this whole range of examples, they kind of fit the definition of free universities, which means that there's this very long, very rich, and very interesting history behind it. There are some examples of projects from history that were direct inspirations for the various organizers and participants with whom I met across North America. Examples like the Escuela Moderna, which was an anarchist school that ran for only a number of years in Spain at the turn of the 20th century. And many, many other examples besides.
So as we begin to wrap up, I'm curious about the big question, and you pose it in your writings about free universities, the question of whether free universities are working to save conventional universities, destroy them, or replace them. What do you think?
Again, a complex question. I think that, I mean, I hope that this doesn't sound like a cop-out answer. I think it really depends on the project itself. But I think that there aren't very many that are actually working to destroy or replace the conventional university. And I think that for a couple of reasons. I think that these projects tend to occupy the very fringes of political movements. And so there weren't many organizers with whom I met who saw their project as having a real potential to exert any kind of strong material impact on normal universities. But the other reason, which leads me to think that these aren't projects that are working to destroy or replace conventional universities, is that they're predominantly, if not entirely, organized and attended by people who really value learning, including forms of learning that they've experienced on the inside, quote unquote, of normal or conventional universities. And so they're projects that are formed out of not so much an antagonism or a pure resistance, but kind of a bittersweet love, kind of a love that's tainted by disappointment, that's oriented towards the normal university. So people, if anything, they want to engage in some form of symbolic and creative and aesthetic and playful resistance that might bring people to think differently about what's possible on the inside of a normal university as well. And I think that the intention, for the most part, is for those changes to be able to be birthed in more creative and radical ways because of the nature of spaces that are freed of the fetters of normal universities, but they're wanting for those changes to be able to flow back into normal universities as well. So it's not, and this is an important point, and a number of people said this to me directly, that their project is not an either or. It's not either free universities or conventional universities. It's a both and. And it's a project that aims to improve quote-unquote mainstream institutions rather than dismantle them altogether. It's a provocation, but it's a provocation that's not intended to be violent. It's intended to be fun and creative and playful and to work hand in hand with what's going on the inside as well. There's a lot of really fruitful struggle going on the inside of universities, and I think that there's a lot of crossover happening between those struggles and the prefigurative work of free universities. All that being said, I should point out that the dynamics I've just been describing, they don't apply across the board to free universities and free schools. In fact, many of the projects I met with, they didn't necessarily establish themselves with any reference to normal schools or universities. They describe themselves more as projects of learning and of study that run, if you like, alongside or despite the existence of normal schools and universities. And many of them reference each other. Many of these free university projects found themselves with relation to one another rather than in these sorts of messy relationships to more mainstream institutions of education.
You write that one of the most significant things I have learned, and this is from your experience founding, co-founding the Brisbane Free University and participating in it, organizing it. One of the most significant things I have learned is how I would like to learn, which is how, Fern?
Gosh, that's a difficult one to answer, surprisingly. And I think partly because one of the things that I learned through being involved with the Brisbane Free University is that I really value learning when it remains open-ended and it remains open to constant reevaluation and interrogation and improvisation. I think that there's a lot of the improvisatory within the pedagogical work of free universities. And so, once again, I think I can only offer you a messy at best answer to a very good question, which is that I'd like to learn in ways that remain collaborative and open and that don't ever coagulate into any fixed kind of form of pedagogy or ideology, but that remain messy and hands-on and open to surprise. I think that was a really big one for me, is that you never know who's going to crop up in these sorts of circles or who's going to have some idea that you've never thought of before. And so I think that openness is really key for me.
So Fern, a lot of people talk of capitalism and its impact on society and on individuals in materialist terms, right? They look for concrete material effects, and you draw on the scholar activist Max Haven, who you've mentioned and who's been on this program, in talking about capitalism's ability to reshape something that's immaterial, namely our imaginations. And you referred earlier to kind of the project of free universities to reshape our imaginations, perhaps to move our imaginations in ways that are very different than what capitalism tries to do and is doing to our imaginative spheres. So what is your sense of what free universities can do and in fact are doing on the level of imagination?
This is such an important point. I'm glad that you asked the question. Yeah, and I think that Max Haven is a really important scholar activist whose work I would turn to theorize this, but it's also worth mentioning Karl Polanyi, who was writing about similar phenomena, but he was writing in the 1940s, I believe, about how when capitalist economic systems transform societies, they don't only transform societies at the level of economy, but also across a whole suite of social and psychological and cultural levels. And it's without those latter three shifts, the economic transformations would not be able to take full hold. Of course, there's always resistances to those transformations that mobilize, again, not only on the economic levels, but on social, psychological and cultural levels as well. And I think that that's where I saw some really important work being done within the realm of free universities and the sorts of struggles that they mobilize. And again, I mean, I alluded to this earlier in the interview, but it's only one small part of the project for free universities to remove a cash price entry from their sessions. But I've come to think of their work using the term, this is kind of a clunky imagery still, but through an idea like palimpsest, that we can take a space that we're used to engaging with in terms of market values. And I think that the parking lot that we use for the Brisbane Free University is a really nice example of this because, and I forgot to mention this earlier, but the parking lot was actually under one of the major Australian banks. It was under one of their branches. And so people would enter and see this big neon bank sign above the parking lot, but then we'd have these free access sessions often on anti-capitalist topics underneath. And so my hope was that what was happening for people in terms of their psychological connotations with that particular space is that those connotations were being overwritten, even if only partially and ephemerally, with other possibilities and other potentialities, that they were used to seeing that sign and recognizing a particular set of values, market values, the neoliberal individualized subject, entrepreneurialism, all of these things that banks have come to symbolize culturally and psychologically. They were overriding that, or at least chipping away at that particular stronghold with other potentialities that they'd not only seen but directly experienced in the space. And for me, that provides a kind of a breathing room from capitalism that I think is, sure, immaterial, but vitally important and can have material upshots as well. I think that it can give us, on the one hand, some relief from interacting with each other always through the medium of the cash economy and capitalist systems. But I think on the other hand, it can bring us to think differently in ways that sediment and remain present for us in the longer term. And that can have shifts in how we interact with each other in a material sense that can take root in our everyday. And that's something that is so difficult to quantify. It's so impossible to measure. But I think it's really vitally important, and it's something that I am convinced that I saw happening. At least I experienced it happening myself.
Fern Thompsett is her name, Thompsett. She is, again, working toward her PhD in anthropology at McGill University, co-founder of the Brisbane Free University in Australia in 2012. She contributed a chapter about free universities to the volume Anthropologies of Value, in which she discusses the research she's done on over 24 free university projects in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Fern, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.